33. With all of her Christmas shopping completed and the bulk of her work correspondence caught up, Gwendy spends the Monday and Tuesday before Christmas settling into an almost scandalously lazy routine, for her anyway. On Monday morning, she sleeps in, waking almost 90 minutes later than her usual 6 a.m., having forced herself not to set an alarm the night before, and remains in bed until nearly noon, catching up on news programs and movies on cable. After a luxuriously long bubble bath, she makes a light lunch and retires to the sunroom, where she stretches out on the love seat and alternates between staring out the floor-to-ceiling windows and daydreaming, and reading the new Ridley Pearson thriller deep into the afternoon. Once the December sun begins its inevitable slide toward the horizon, she marks her page, leaves the thick paperback on an end table, and goes upstairs to change clothes. Then she grabs her keys and heads to her parents' house for dinner. After nearly 3 months of being waited on in her own kitchen, Mrs. Peterson is finally feeling strong enough to cook again. Under the watchful eye of her husband, Mrs. Peterson prepares and serves a steaming hot casserole of beef stroganoff and a Christmas tree-shaped platter stacked with homemade rolls. The food is delicious, and Mrs. Peterson is so openly and endearingly pleased with herself, her smiles bring tears to her husband's eyes. After dinner, Gwendy and her father shoo Mrs. Peterson into the den while they clear the table and wash the dishes. Then they join her in watching A Christmas Carol on television and crack open a new jigsaw puzzle. At a few minutes before 9, Gwendy bids her folks goodnight and drives back to the condo. She considers going for a run, but decides against it, working the 3-digit combination on the safe instead and taking out the button box. It keeps her company at the foot of the bed while she changes into a nightgown and brushes her teeth. She finds herself talking to it more and more now, just as she did when she was younger. The box doesn't answer, of course, but she's almost certain that it listens and watches. Before she puts it away for the night, she sits on the edge of the mattress, places the box in her lap, and pulls the lever by the red button. The narrow shelf slides out, and on it is a tiny chocolate monkey. She admires the fine detail and then slowly lifts it to her nose and inhales. Her eyes flutter closed. When she opens them again, she gets up and walks at a deliberate pace to the bathroom, where she flushes the chocolate down the toilet. Unlike last time, there is no panic and there are no tears. "See," she says to the box as she re-enters the bedroom, "I'm in control here, not you." And then she returns the button box to the safe and goes to sleep. Tuesday is more or less a repeat performance of the day before, and there are moments when Gwendy can't help but think of scenes from Groundhog Day, that silly movie Ryan likes so much. She starts the day by again sleeping in and lounging in bed for most of the morning. Then she takes a long bath, finishes the Pearson novel shortly after lunch, and devours the first 4 chapters of a new John Grisham. She's not in much of a holiday mood, but she forces herself to haul out the artificial tree and boxes of ornaments from the crawl space. She sets up the tree in the corner of the family room and hangs last year's wreath on the front door. When dusk descends upon Castle Rock, she goes upstairs to change and heads to her parents for another dose of Mom's home cooking. Lasagna and salad are on the menu tonight, and Gwendy eats 2 generous servings of each. After dinner, she and her father once again take care of the dishes and then join Mrs. Peterson in the den. Tonight's feature is White Christmas, and when the movie's over and the credits are rolling, Mr. Peterson shocks both his wife and daughter by rolling up his pant legs, doing his best Bing Crosby imitation, and performing the sisters' routine in its entirety. Mrs. Peterson, hardly believing her eyes, collapses onto the sofa laughing so hard she ends up having a coughing fit, prompting her husband to hightail it into the kitchen for a glass of cold water. She takes a big drink, starts hiccuping, and lets out a tremendous belch, and the 3 of them burst into delirious laughter all over again. The party breaks up a short time later, and Gwendy heads home, snow flurries dancing in the beam of her car's headlights. She takes her time driving across town and walks into her condo at precisely 9:30, juggling and almost dropping the stack of Tupperware containers her mom sent home with her. There's enough leftover lasagna, stroganoff, and cheesecake in there to last well into the new year. She's struggling to open the refrigerator when her cell phone rings. Gwendy glances at the counter where she left the phone next to her keys and turns her attention back to the refrigerator. She slides the largest container onto the top shelf, next to half-empty cartons of milk and orange juice, and is trying to make room on a lower shelf when the phone rings again. She ignores it and jams in the other two containers, one after the other. The phone rings a third time as Gwendy is closing the refrigerator door, and it's almost as if a lightning bolt reaches down from the heavens and strikes some sense into her. She lunges for the cell phone, knocking her keys onto the floor. Hello? Hello? At first, there's nothing, and then a burst of loud static. Hello? She says again, disappointment washing over her. Is anyone? Hey, baby girl. I was just about to hang up. Every muscle in her body goes limp, and she has to lean against the table to keep from falling. Ryan, she says, but it comes out in a whisper. You there, Gwen? I'm here, honey. I'm so happy to hear your voice. The tears come now, gushing down her face. Listen, I don't know how long this line's going to last. We haven't even been able to file our reports with the magazine or any of the newspapers. Yesterday, fires all over the place. Are you okay, Ryan? Are you safe? I'm okay. I wanted to tell you, taking care of myself and doing my best, get home to you. I miss you so damn much, she says, unable to keep the emotion from her voice. I miss you too, baby. No one I'll be able to call again, but I'll keep trying. By Christmas. You're breaking up. Staccato bursts of static hijack the line. Gwendy pulls the phone away from her ear and waits for them to decrease in intensity. Amidst the noise, she hears her husband's faint voice. Love you. She presses the phone back to her ear. Hello? Are you still there? Please take care of yourself, Ryan. She's nearly shouting now. The line crackles and then goes silent. She holds it tight against her ear, listening and hoping for one more word, anything, but it doesn't come. I love you more, she finally whispers, and ends the call. 34. 48 hours of laziness. She tries to tell herself she wasn't actually being lazy, she was simply relaxing and decompressing, but she's not buying it, is all Gwendy can tolerate. On Wednesday, she wakes up at dawn and goes for a run. A sleety, granular snow is falling, and the roads are slick with ice, but Gwendy pushes forward, the hood of her sweatshirt cinched tight around her face. Running through downtown Castle Rock is usually a comforting experience for Gwendy. She jogs her normal route, down Main Street, avoiding the unshoveled sidewalks, past the common, the library, and the Western Auto, circling the long way around the hospital, and heading uptown past the Knights of Columbus Hall and back toward View Drive, and she feels a sense of rightness in her world, a sense of belonging. She's traveled all over the country for her work, first as an ad exec, then as a writer-filmmaker, and finally as a public servant. But there's only one Castle Rock, Maine. Just as her mother had told the stranger in the black hat at the mall, this is home. But something feels off today. This morning she feels like a visitor traveling through a foreign and unfriendly landscape. Her mind is cluttered and distracted, her legs sluggish and heavy. At first she blames this feeling on the way her phone call with Ryan ended the night before, so abrupt and unsettled. After hanging up, she cried herself to sleep with worry. But when she passes in front of the sheriff's station as she makes her way uptown, she realizes it's something else entirely. For the first time, she understands how much she's dreading the difficult task that awaits her later that morning. 35. Gwendy's first impression of Caroline Hoffman is that she's a woman who is used to getting her own way. When Gwendy walks into the station house at 9:50 a.m., a full 10 minutes early for the meeting, she's hoping the Hoffmans haven't arrived yet so she and Sheriff Ridgwick will have time to discuss the investigation. Instead, the three of them are waiting for her in the conference room. There's no sign of Sheila Brigham, the longtime dispatcher for the Castle Rock Sheriff's Department, so Deputy George Footman escorts Gwendy inside and closes the door behind her. Sheriff Ridgwick sits on one side of a long, narrow table, a chair standing empty next to him. Mr. and Mrs. Hoffman sit side by side across from him, a second empty chair separating them. They make an interesting couple. Frank Hoffman is slight in stature, bespectacled, and dressed in a wrinkled brown suit that has seen better days. He has dark circles under his eyes and a slender nose that has been broken more than once. Caroline Hoffman is at least 3 or 4 inches taller than her husband, and thick and broad across the shoulders and chest. She could be a female lumberjack, something not unheard of in this part of the world. She's wearing jeans and a gray Harley Davidson sweatshirt with the sleeves rolled up. A tattoo of a boat anchor decorates one meaty forearm. "Sorry to keep you waiting," Gwendy says, taking a seat beside the sheriff. She places her leather tote on the table in front of her, but quickly removes it and puts it on the floor when she realizes it's dripping wet from melting snow. She uses the sleeve of her sweater to wipe up the small puddle left behind.
"Morning, Congresswoman," Sheriff Ridgwick says.
"Can we get started now?"
Mrs. Hoffman asks, glaring at the sheriff.
"Sure thing."
Gwendy leans forward and extends her hand, first to Mr. Hoffman, then to his wife. "Good morning, I'm Gwendy Peterson. I'm very sorry to meet you both under these circumstances."
"Good morning,"
Mr. Hoffman says in a surprisingly deep voice.
"We know who you are," Mrs. Hoffman says, wiping her hand on her pant leg like she touched something unsavory. "Question is, how are you going to help us?"
"Well," Gwendy says, "I'll do whatever I can to help locate your daughter, Mrs. Hoffman. If Sheriff Ridgwick needs..."
"Her name is Carla,"
the big woman interrupts, eyes narrowing again.
"Least you can do is say her damn name."
"Of course. I'll do whatever I can to help find Carla. If the sheriff needs additional personnel, I'll make sure he has it. If he needs more equipment or vehicles, I'll make sure he has that too, whatever it takes." Mrs. Hoffman looks at Sheriff Ridgwick.
"What the sheriff needs is someone to come in here and show him how to do his job properly."
Gwendy bristles. "Now, wait a minute, Mrs. Hoffman." The sheriff touches Gwendy's forearm, silencing her. He looks at the Hoffmans.
"I know you folks are desperate for answers. I know you're unhappy with the way the investigation is progressing."
Mrs. Hoffman snickers.
"Progressing."
"But I assure you, me and my men are working around the clock to chase down every single scrap of possible evidence. No one will rest until we find out what happened to your daughter."
"We're just so worried,"
Mr. Hoffman says.
"We're both sick with worry."
"I understand that," the sheriff says. "We all do.
Jenny Tucker over the hair salon says your guys were checking out the Henderson's farm yesterday," Mrs. Hoffman says. "Want to tell me why that is?"
The sheriff sighs and shakes his head.
"Jenny Tucker's the biggest gossip in town, you know that."
"Doesn't make it not true."
"No, it doesn't, but in this case, it's not true. Far as I know, no one's been out to the Henderson place."
"Why not?" she presses. "From what I hear, he did time in Shawshank when he was younger."
"Hell, Mrs. Hoffman, half the hard-grit laborers in Castle County served time at one point or another. We can't go searching all their houses."
"Tell us this," she says, cocking her head to the side like an agitated rooster, "and give us a straight answer for a change. What do you have? After a full week of walking around in circles, what do you have?"
Sheriff Ridgwick lets out a deep breath.
"We've talked about all this before. I can't tell you anything more than I already have. In order to protect the integrity of the investigation..."
Mrs. Hoffman slams a heavy fist down on the table, startling everyone in the room.
"Bullshit!"
"Caroline,"
Mr. Hoffman says,
"maybe we should..."
Mrs. Hoffman turns on her husband, eyes burning. The thick veins in her neck look like they're going to explode.
"They got nothing, Frank, just like I told you. They ain't got a goddamn thing." Gwendy has been listening to all of this with a sense of disconnected awe, almost as though she were sitting in the front row of a studio audience at an afternoon talk show. But something inside her awakens now. She raises a hand in an effort to take control of the room and says, "Why don't we all just take a minute and start over again?" Glaring at Gwendy, Mrs. Hoffman suddenly jerks to her feet, knocking over her chair.
"Why don't you save that happy horseshit for the folks around here who were dumb enough to vote for you?"
She kicks the chair out from under her feet, spittle spraying from the corners of her mouth.
"Coming in here with your fancy clothes, $500 boots, trying to shine us on like we're stupid or something."
Flinging open the door, she storms out. Gwendy stares after Mrs. Hoffman with her mouth hanging open.
"I didn't mean to. I was just trying..."
Mr. Hoffman stands.
"Congresswoman, Sheriff, you'll have to excuse my wife. She's very upset."
"It's no problem at all," Sheriff Ridgwick says, escorting him to the door. "We understand."
"I apologize if anything I said made matters worse," Gwendy says. Mr. Hoffman shakes his head.
"Things can't get much worse, ma'am."
He looks closely at Gwendy.
"Do you have children of your own, Congresswoman?"
Gwendy tries to swallow the lump that rises in her throat.
"No, I don't."
Mr. Hoffman looks down at the ground and nods, but he doesn't say anything further. Then he shuffles out of the room. Sheriff Ridgwick stares after him and turns back to Gwendy.
"That went well."
Gwendy looks around the conference room, unsure of what to do next. It all happens so fast, her head is swirling. She finally blurts out,
"I bought these boots at Target."
36. Gwendy mopes around the condo for the rest of the afternoon, watching cable news and drinking too much coffee. She left the sheriff's office hours earlier feeling depressed and incompetent in equal measures, like she let everyone in the room down. She obviously said something to stoke Mrs. Hoffman's ire, and the sheriff was doing just fine handling the two of them before she went and opened her big mouth. And that smart-ass comment about her clothes and boots, it bothered Gwendy. It shouldn't have, she knows that, but it did. Since returning to Castle Rock after all those years away, she'd grown used to the occasional snide dig. It came with the territory. So why did she let it get to her like that?
"Well, don't just sit there," she says to the button box. "Figure it out and get back to me."
The box ignores her. It sits there on the end table next to a half-empty mug of coffee and an outdated TV guide and answers her with stubborn silence. She grabs the remote and turns up the volume on the television. President Hamlin stands at the edge of the White House lawn, his arms crossed in defiance, the Marine One helicopter whirling in the background.
"And if they continue to make these threats against the United States of America," he says, flashing his best tough guy look at the camera, "we will have no alternative but to fight power with power. This great country will not back down."
Gwendy watches in disbelief.
Jesus, he thinks he's in a movie.
Her cell phone rings. She knows it's too soon to hear from Ryan again, but she scrambles across the sofa and snatches it up anyway. "Hello?"
"Hey, Gwen, it's Dad."
"I was just thinking about you guys," she says, muting the television. "Need me to bring anything for dinner?" There's a slight pause before he answers.
"That's why I'm calling.
Would you be terribly upset if we canceled tonight?"
"Of course not," she says, sitting up. "Is everything okay?"
"Everything's fine. Mom's just kind of dragging after her doctor's appointment this afternoon. Tell you the truth, so am I."
"Do you want me to pick up something from Pizzano's and drop it off? I'd be happy to."
"That's sweet of you, but no, we're good. I'm going to reheat some lasagna, and we're hitting the sack early."
"Okay, but call me if you change your mind, and give Mom my best."
"I will, honey. Thanks for being such a great daughter."
"Night, Dad."
Gwendy hangs up and looks at the Christmas tree standing in the corner. A string of lights has gone out.
"Yeah, some great daughter. I completely forgot she even had a doctor's appointment today."
She gets up and takes a couple of steps into the middle of the room and then stops. Suddenly, she wants to cry. And not just your garden variety sniffles, either. She feels like dropping to her knees, burying her face in her hands and sobbing until she passes out. A tightness growing in her chest, Gwendy slumps onto the sofa again. This is pathetic, she thinks, wiping away tears with the heels of her hands. Absolutely pathetic. Maybe a hot bath and a glass of wine will... And then she looks at the button box. '37. Gwendy can't remember the last time she went on two runs in the same day. If she had to guess, she'd say it was the summer when she was 12 years old, the same summer Frankie Stone started calling her Goodyear, and she finally decided to do something about her weight. She ran pretty much everywhere that summer, to the corner store to pick up eggs and bread for her mother, to Olive's house to listen to records and tear through the latest issue of Teen magazine. And, of course, every morning, even on Sundays, she ran the suicide stairs up to Castleview Park. By the time school started in September, Gwendy had lost almost 15 pounds of baby fat, and the button box was hidden away in the bottom of her bedroom closet. After that, life would never be the same for her. Tonight she jogs at a fast clip along the center line of Route 117, enjoying the feel of her heart pounding in her chest. The snow stopped falling several hours earlier, right around dinner time, and the plows are busy clearing side streets at this late hour. The main roadways are eerily empty and hushed. At the bottom of the hill, she passes a group of men wearing hard hats and orange vests with CRPW stenciled on them, Castle Rock Public Works. One of them drops the shovel he's working and gives her an enthusiastic round of applause. She flashes the man a smile and a thumbs up and keeps on trucking. The tiny piece of chocolate, the button box dispensed, was in the shape of an owl, and Gwendy stared in rapt fascination at the amazing details, the staggered lines of each feather, the pointy tip of its beak, the pools of dark shadow that made up its eyes, before popping it into her mouth and allowing it to dissolve on her tongue. There was a moment of complete satisfaction at what she didn't know, maybe everything. And then a rush of startling clarity and energy spread throughout her body. All of a sudden, she not only no longer felt like crying, her entire body felt lighter, her vision seemed clearer, and the colors in the condo appeared brighter and more vibrant. Was this what it was like when she was younger? She couldn't exactly remember. All she knew was that it suddenly felt like she'd sprouted wings and could fly up into the sky and touch the moon. She immediately changed into workout clothes and running shoes and headed outside. Nope, not immediately, she reminds herself, as she cruises past the Sunoco station toward Main Street and the center of town. Something else happened first. In the midst of all those good feelings, those wonderful feelings, she suddenly found herself fixating on the red button at the left side of the box, and then slowly reaching out with a finger and touching it, caressing its glassy surface. And the thought of actually pressing it and erasing President Richard Hamlin from the face of the earth wormed itself inside the basement of her brain like the wisp of a forgotten dream just before waking. "Whoa, girl," a little voice whispered inside her head. "Be careful what you daydream, because that box can hear you thinking. Don't you doubt it, not even for a second." Then, and only then, did she carefully withdraw her finger and go upstairs to change into running gear. 38. The next day dawns clear and cold. A brisk wind blows in from the east, swirling amongst the treetops and drifting mounds of snow against the tires of parked cars and the sides of buildings. In the glare of morning sun, the blanket of ice-crusted snow is almost too brilliant to look at. Gwendy pulls her car to the shoulder of the narrow back road and takes off her sunglasses. A half dozen sheriff's department vehicles are parked in a staggered line in front of her. A group of uniformed officers huddle between two of the cars, heads down, lost in conversation. An open field of maybe 15 or 20 acres, bordered by deep woods, stretches out along the right side of the road. Thick trees crowd the other side, blocking the sun's rays and dropping the temperature there by at least 10 degrees. Sheriff Ridgwick spots her car and disengages from the other men. He starts walking in her direction, so Gwendy gets out and meets him halfway.
"Thanks for coming on short notice," he says. "I thought you'd want to be here."
"What's going on?" she asks, zipping up her heavy jacket. "Did you find the girls?"
"No," he looks out across the open field. "Not yet. But we did find the sweatshirt Carla Hoffman was wearing the night she disappeared."
She looks around. "All the way out here?"
He nods and points at the northeast corner of the field.
Gwendy follows his finger, and squinting, she can just make out a couple of dark figures camouflaged by the backdrop of trees.
"One of my men spotted it this morning. Wind was blowing so hard, it was actually moving across the field. That's what caught his attention, that and the color."
"Color?"
"We knew from talking to Carla's older brother that she'd been wearing a pink Nike sweatshirt the night she was taken. The officer saw something small and pink tumbling across the field and pulled over. At first he thought it was just a plastic grocery bag. Wind blows hard, like today. These trees act like a kind of wind tunnel and all kind of crap flies through here. Empty cans, fast food litter, plastic bags, paper bags, you name it."
"Sounds like your officer deserves a raise for checking it out."
"He's a good man."
The sheriff looks closely at Gwendy.
"All of my men and women are."
"So what happens next?"
"Evidence is out there now looking at the sweatshirt. Deputy Footman's pulling in some additional bodies to conduct a search of the surrounding area. You're welcome to help if you like. Half the town will probably show up if we let them."
Gwendy nods her head.
"I think I will. I have a hat and gloves in the car." "Hell of a way to spend the day before Christmas Eve," he sighs deeply. "Anyway, probably another hour or so before we get started. Might as well get inside and run the heater."
He starts back toward the other men.
"There's coffee and donuts in one of the patrol cars if you want."
Gwendy doesn't acknowledge the offer. She's staring at the snow-covered field, her brow furrowed. "Sheriff, if your deputy found the sweatshirt blowing around on top of the snow, and it just stopped snowing yesterday afternoon sometime, that means the sweatshirt was left sometime in the last," she thinks, 16 hours, give or take."
"Maybe," he says, "unless it was somewhere under cover and the wind shook it loose after the snow stopped."
"Huh," Gwendy says, "I didn't think of that."
"All I know is there are no houses within 3 miles of us, and this stretch of road is mainly used by hunters. The sweatshirt either found us by accident, or we were meant to find it."
He glances at the men huddled between the cars, then looks back at Gwendy.
"My money's on the second one."
39. Sheriff Ridgwick is right about one thing. Half the town of Castle Rock shows up for the search. At least that's how it appears to Gwendy, as she takes her place in the long, arcing line of locals, most of the women dressed in colorful winter coats and boots, most of the men wearing the standard autumn uniform of an adult New England male. Camouflage. As they begin fanning out across the field, Gwendy looks around and sees old folks walking alongside young couples, and young couples walking alongside college and high school kids. Even under these dreary circumstances, the sight brings a brief smile to her face. For all its dark history and idiosyncrasies, Castle Rock is still a place that takes care of its own. The sheriff's instructions to the group are simple enough. Walk slowly, side by side, with no more than 5 or 6 feet separating you from the person on your right and the person on your left. If you find something, anything, don't touch it and don't get too close. Call for one of the officers and they'll come running. Gwendy stares at the snow-covered terrain in front of her, willing her feet to move deliberately despite the frigid temperature pushing her to pick up the pace. Her cheeks burn and her eyes water from the constant gusts of wind. For the first time that morning, her thoughts stray to the button box. She knows that eating the chocolate was a mistake, a moment of weakness, and is determined not to allow it to happen again. Sure, it made her feel better last night. Okay, it did much more than that, if she's being perfectly honest with herself. And when she looked in the bathroom mirror this morning, feeling more rested and purer in soul than she's felt in months, and noticed the dark circles that had taken up residence under her eyes the past few weeks had vanished, all of a sudden, the magic chocolates didn't seem like such a bad idea after all. But then she remembered her finger brushing against the smooth surface of the red button, and that little voice whispering inside her head. Be careful what you daydream, because that box can hear you thinking. And she shuddered at the memory and tried her best to push it far, far away.
Wendy, dear, a voice says, startling her from her thoughts. How is your mother doing?
Gwendy cranes her head forward and looks first to her right and then to her left. An older woman a few spots down the line lifts a gloved hand and waves. Mrs. Verrill, I didn't even see you there. The woman smiles back at her.
It's okay, dear. It's hard to tell who's who all bundled up like this.
Mom's doing much better. Thank you for asking. She's back in the kitchen and ready to kick my father out of the house so she can have some peace and quiet. Mrs. Verrill lifts a hand to her mouth and chuckles.
Well, please tell her I said hello and that I would love to stop by and see her sometime.
I'll do that, Mrs. Verrill. I'm sure she'd be thrilled to see you.
Thank you, dear.
Gwendy smiles and returns her focus to the field of untouched snow stretching out before her. She guesses it's maybe another 50 or 60 yards before they reach the tree line. Then what, she thinks. Do we turn around or plow ahead? She must have missed that part of Sheriff Ridgewick's. Sensing that the man walking to her immediate right is staring at her, Gwendy glances in his direction. She's right. His brown eyes are closely studying her. The man is young, early 20s, and is underdressed in an untucked flannel shirt and Buffalo Bills baseball cap. He suddenly grins and looks right past her.
I told you it was her, Pops.
Excuse me, she says, confused. A quiet voice from her left says,
I thought for sure she was too young to be a governor or senator.
Gwendy looks from her left to her right and back again. I'm not either one. The older man scratches at his unshaven chin.
Then what are you?
She's a congresswoman, says the young man with a look of embarrassment.
I told you that.
I'm afraid you two have lost me, Gwendy says, exasperated. Have we met before? No, ma'am. My name is Lucas Brown, and that there's my father.
Charlie, the other man says, placing his hand on his stomach and giving a little bow. Third generation Castle Rock.
Wait a minute. So your name is Charlie Brown?
He bows again. At your service.
The younger man groans and blushes an even deeper shade of red. They're actually kind of charming, Gwendy thinks. Anyway, I saw you standing there when the sheriff was talking, Lucas says. I nudged my pops and I told him who you were. He looks at his father with a raised chin. But he didn't believe me.
I didn't, I admit it, he says, hands raised. Thought you had to be a lot older to work high up in the government like that.
Gwendy gives him a big smile. Well, I'll take that as a compliment, thank you.
Beaming, the older man puffs his chest out. My boy there, he's the smart one in the family. 2 years of college down there in Buffalo before he ran into a bit of trouble. But he'll go back and finish what he started one day soon. Ain't that right, son?
Lucas, suddenly looking like he'd rather be anywhere else in the world right then, nods his head. Yes, sir, one day. Well, it's a pleasure to meet you both, Gwendy says, anxious to move on from the conversation. It's always nice to get to know.
What's that?
Lucas asks, pointing at a small dark object emerging from the trees in front of them. A murmur of raised voices travels down the line of searchers. People start pointing. Someone on the far left flank breaks formation and chases after the object, slipping and sprawling face first in the snow. Several people sarcastically cheer. At first, Gwendy thinks it's a plastic grocery bag, like the sheriff had described earlier. It's the right size and shape, and it's riding the wind's currents up, down, swirling in tight little circles, tumbling wildly to the ground and then surfing back up again. But then halfway across the open field, the object appears to inexplicably change direction in mid-flight. Banking hard to the right, it heads directly toward her. And Gwendy flashes back to a blustery, golden-hued April afternoon she once spent at the side of a boy she loved, flying kites and holding hands and feeling like their happiness would last forever. And at that moment, she understands it's a hat swooping toward her in the whipping wind. A small, neat, black hat. The dark object suddenly veers to the left, hurtling away from her at terrific speed. And for one fleeting, hopeful moment, Gwendy believes she's wrong. It's just a grocery bag after all. But then the wind squalls again and it loops back around, coming closer and closer, swerving and somersaulting across the frozen ground directly at her feet. Where Lucas Brown leaps forward and stomps on it, abruptly halting its long journey.
"Would you look at that," Charlie Brown says, eyes wide as 1891 silver dollars.
He bends down to pick it up.
"Stop," Gwendy shouts. "Don't touch it."
The older man jerks his hand back and looks up at her.
"Why not?"
It could be evidence.
"Oh, yeah,"
he says, straightening up and smacking himself a good one on the side of his head. A small crowd has gathered around them by now.
"What is it? Is that what I think it is?"
"Did you see that sucker move almost like someone was working a remote control?"
Deputy Footman sidesteps his way through the group of onlookers.
"What have you got there?"
"Sorry about that, officer," Lucas says, removing his boot from the object. "Only way I could stop it."
The deputy doesn't say anything. He drops to a knee in the snow and carefully examines the object. It's not a grocery bag, of course. It's a hat. A small, neat, black hat. Faded with age, tattered and worn around the edges of the brim, a ragged 3-inch tear slicing across the top of the crushed dome.
"This thing's been out here forever," the deputy says, rising to his feet. "It's no help to us."
He walks away, and the crowd begins to dissipate. Gwendy doesn't move. Biting her lip, she stares down at the black hat, almost hypnotized by the sight of it, unaware that Charlie Brown and his son are watching her. Is Ferris sending some kind of a message? Or is he playing games with me, making up for lost time? She bends down to get a better look at the filthy hat, and a gust of wind picks it up and swoops it away from her, sending it hurtling toward the road. It climbs and climbs, then plummets to the ground, rolling on its side like a child's frisbee for several yards before lifting up and taking flight once again. Gwendy stands in the middle of the snow-covered field, eyes lifted to the sky, and watches as the black hat disappears into the trees beyond the road. When she turns around, the staggered human chain of searchers has moved on without her. Homeland Cemetery is the largest and prettiest of Castle Rock's three graveyards. There are tall iron gates out front with a lock, but it's used only twice a year, on graduation night at the high school and on Halloween. Sheriff George Bannerman is buried in Homeland, as is Reginald Pop Merrill, one of the town's most infamous and unsavory citizens. Gwendy drives through the ornate gates just as dusk is settling over the land, and she can't decide whether the cemetery, with its rolling hills and stone monuments and lengthening shadows, appears tranquil or menacing. Maybe both, she decides, parking along the central lane and getting out. Maybe both. Knowing where she's going, she walks a direct route, punching her way through knee-deep snow to a scattering of grave markers that rest atop a steep hillside skirted by a small grove of pine trees. There are smudges of naked earth here, where the tree's thick branches have prevented snow from accumulating below. The treetops sway back and forth overhead, whispering secrets to each other in the cold breeze. Gwendy stops in front of a small marker in the last row. The trees grow close together, blocking the day's dying light and casting the ground in shadow. But she knows who's carved into the headstone by memory. Olive Grace Kepnes,
1962 to 1979. Our loving angel. She drops to a knee in the snow, only several inches deep here, and traces the grooves with her bare fingertips. As always, she thinks whoever was in charge of the inscription did a pretty shitty job of it. Where were the exact dates of Olive's birth and death? Those were important days to remember and should have been included. And what did our loving angel have to say about the real Olive Kepnes? Nothing. It said nothing at all to keep her memory alive. Why didn't it mention that Olive had an infectious laugh and knew more about Peter Frampton than anyone else in the world? Or that she was a connoisseur of all types of candy and bad horror movies on late-night television? Or that she wanted to be a veterinarian when she grew up? Gwendy kneels in the snow, feet numb despite her waterproof boots thanks to hours of fruitless searching earlier in the afternoon, and visits with her old friend until the pools of shadow melt together into one. And then she says goodbye and slowly walks back in the dark to her car. 41. Gwendy locks the car and is halfway up the sidewalk to her condo when she hears footsteps behind her. She glances over her shoulder, scanning the length of the parking lot. At first, she doesn't see anyone, even though she can still hear the hurried footfalls. Then she spots him, a man, lost in the shadows between streetlights, striding toward her, maybe 30 yards away and moving fast. Gwendy hurries to the entrance and punches in her security code with shaky fingers. She tries to open the door, but it doesn't budge. She looks behind her again, panicking now. The man is closer, maybe 15 yards away. She can't be 100% certain in the dark, but it looks like he's wearing a ski mask obscuring his face, just like in her dream. Gwendy punches in the code again, concentrating on each button. The door buzzes. She flings it open, steps inside, and slams it shut behind her, sprinting up the stairs to the second floor. As she fumbles with her keys outside the door to her condo, she hears someone rattling the entrance door downstairs, trying to get in. She finally gets the door unlocked and rushes inside. After locking the deadbolt, she hurries to the front window and takes a peek outside. The parking lot is empty. The man is nowhere in sight. 42.
Morning, Sheila, Gwendy says, a little too eager for the early hour. I'm here to see Sheriff Ridgwick. The scarecrow thin woman with bright red hair and matching eyeglasses looks up from the magazine she's reading.
Hey there, Gwendy. Sorry I missed you the other day. Heard there was some fireworks.
Sheila Brigham has manned the glass-walled dispatch cubicle at the Castle County Sheriff's Department for going on 25 years now. She's also in charge of the front desk and coffee maker. Sheila started on the job fresh out of community college, when bell-bottoms were all the rage and George Bannerman was patrolling the Rock. She got married and raised a family here and took good care of Alan Pangborn during his decade-long stint and, unlike most folks, didn't let the fire of 91 scare her away, even though she'd spent nearly 3 weeks in a hospital bed in the aftermath of that disaster.
I'm afraid I didn't inspire much confidence in our elected officials, Gwendy says.
Sheila waves a dismissive hand.
Don't worry yourself none about that. Carol Hoffman's mean as a hornet on a good day, and she doesn't have many of those.
Still, I feel horrible, that poor woman. Sheila makes a grunting sound.
You want to feel sorry for someone, feel sorry for that husband of hers.
Can't argue with you there. She picks up her magazine.
You can go on back. He's waiting for you.
Thank you. Merry Christmas, Sheila. She makes that same grunting sound and returns her attention to reading. The door to Sheriff Ridgwick's office is open, so Gwendy walks right in. He's sitting behind his desk talking on the telephone. He holds up a finger, mouths 1 minute, and gestures for her to sit down.
I understand that, Jay. I do, but we don't have time. I need it yesterday.
His face darkens.
I don't care. Just get it done.
He hangs up and looks at Gwendy.
Sorry about that.
No problem, she says. Now what's all the secrecy about? Why couldn't you just tell me on the phone? The sheriff shakes his head.
Don't like that cell phone of yours. Last thing we need right now is a leak.
You're as paranoid as my father. He's whipped himself into a frenzy. Thinks all the world's technology is going to collapse when the clock strikes midnight next week.
Tell that to Tommy Perkins. He claims he picks up a half dozen cell phone conversations every day on that shortwave of his.
Gwendy laughs. Tom Perkins is a dirty-minded, senile old man. You really believe what he says?
The sheriff shrugs. How else did he know about Shelley Piper being pregnant before the rest of the town?
Probably did the deed himself, the old perv. The sheriff's jaw drops, his mouth forming a perfect O.
Gwendy Peterson.
Oh, hush, she says, waving a hand at him. And stop stalling, Norris. Is the news that bad? The smile fades from his face.
I'm afraid it is.
Tell me. He gets up and closes the door. Returning to his desk, he opens a drawer and takes out a large envelope.
Take a look, he says, handing it to Gwendy.
She opens the flap and slides out a pair of glossy color photographs. It's hard to tell what the three small white objects are in the first photo, but the second shot is a close-up view and much clearer.
Teeth, she says, looking at the sheriff.
He nods in response.
Where'd they come from? They were found inside the pocket of Carla Hoffman's pink sweatshirt.
43. Gwendy's still thinking about the three small teeth hours later as she showers and gets ready to attend Christmas Eve Mass with her parents. Forensics have already confirmed that the teeth are archetypal for a female Carla Hoffman's age, and Sheriff Ridgwick's in touch with the girl's dental office to determine if they have x-rays on file. Carla's parents know about the sweatshirt, but haven't been told about the gruesome discovery made inside the pocket.
It's our first concrete piece of evidence, the sheriff had confided to Gwendy. We need to see where it leads before news of it gets blabbed all over town.
The discovery of the teeth had pushed thoughts of last night's terrifying encounter in the parking lot out of Gwendy's mind. But they return to her now, 24 hours later, as she's selecting a dress for church. The whole thing feels like a bad dream. The man was wearing a mask, she's sure of that now. But at this time of year, ski masks are common. Other than that, she doesn't remember much of anything. Dark clothing, maybe jeans, and some kind of shoe or boot with a heel. She definitely heard him before she saw him. Another thing, she hadn't noticed any strange cars in the lot, so he either parked somewhere nearby and came on foot, or he lived close by. But why would anyone want to do that, she thinks, settling on a long black dress and a pair of leather boots. Was he just trying to scare her, or was it more than that? For that matter, did he even know it was her? Maybe the whole thing was just a prank, or had nothing to do with her at all. Gwendy also wonders why she chose not to say anything about it to Sheriff Ridgwick this morning, although she has a theory about that. It all points back to the chocolate owl she ate a couple of nights earlier. It's true that eating the chocolate immediately infused her with a sense of calm energy and clearness of vision, both the internal and external variety. But it did more than that. It gave her back her sense of balance in the world, a new sense of confidence that was sorely lacking these past few months. Missing Ryan, floundering at her job, worrying about her mom and a president with the IQ of a turnip and the temperament of a schoolyard bully. All of a sudden, she felt like she could shoulder her share of the load again and more. All thanks to some kind of wonder drug? Or candy, she thinks. It was an uneasy feeling to have, and in some ways it made her feel even guiltier about eating the chocolate. After all, she wasn't a lost and insecure teenager, like the first time the button box came into her life. She was an adult now, with years of experience at handling the curveballs life threw at her. She's strapping on her seatbelt and pulling out of the parking lot on her way to meet her parents at church, when that dreaded question rears its ugly head once again. How much of her life is her own doing, and how much the doing of the box with its treats and buttons? Gwendy has never been less sure of the answer. 44. For as long as Gwendy can remember, the Petersons have attended the 7 p.m. Christmas Eve Mass at Our Lady of Serene Waters Catholic Church,
and then gone crosstown to the Bradleys' annual holiday party afterward. When she was a little girl, Gwendy would often spend the drowsy drive home with her head resting against the cool glass of her backseat window, searching the night sky for a glimpse of Rudolph's glowing red nose. The church service tonight lasts a little more than an hour. Hugh and Blanche Goff, the Petersons' longtime next-door neighbors, arrive a few minutes late. Gwendy happily scoots over to make room for them in the pew. Mrs. Goff smells like mothballs and peppermint breath mints, which Gwendy doesn't mind. The Goffs were never able to have children of their own, and she's like a surrogate daughter to them. Gwendy closes her eyes and loses herself in Father Lawrence's sermon, his soothing voice as much a part of her childhood memories as Saturday morning swims with Olive Kepnes at the Castle Rock Rec pool. Few of the priest's stories are new to her, but she finds his words and delivery comforting nonetheless. Gwendy watches the simple joy in her mother's face as Mrs. Peterson sings along with the choir and, a short time later, stifles a giggle when Mr. Goff breaks wind during Holy Communion, earning a gentle elbow to the ribs from her father. When the service is over, the Petersons file out with the rest of the congregation and stand outside the church's main entrance, mingling with friends and neighbors. The most boisterous greetings are reserved for Gwendy's mom, as this is her first time back at church in weeks. There is one exception, however. Father Lawrence wraps Gwendy up in a bear hug and actually lifts her off the ground. Before he disappears back into the rectory, he makes her promise to come back soon. Once the crowd thins out, Gwendy walks Mr. and Mrs. Goff to their car in the parking lot, and then she follows her parents to the Bradleys' mansion on Willow Street. Anita Bradley, as Castle Rock gossips have enviously whispered for going on 3 decades now, married old and married rich. After her husband Lester, a wildly successful lumber tycoon 19 years her senior, suffered a fatal heart attack in early 1991, many locals thought that once the funeral services were completed and legal matters attended to, Anita would pack up house and head for the sunny shores of Florida, or maybe even an island somewhere. But they were wrong. Castle Rock was her home, Anita insisted, and she wasn't going anywhere. As it turns out, her staying was a very good thing for the town. Anita has spent the almost 9 years since her husband's death donating her time and money to a long list of local charities, volunteering her sewing expertise to help out the Castle Rock High School Theatrical Society, and serving as the head of the library's board of trustees. She also makes a ridiculously delicious apple pie, which she sells at Nora's Bake Shop all summer long. A smiling and moderately tipsy Anita, her long, thick gray hair styled into some kind of gravity-defeating triple-decker power tower, welcomes the Peterson family inside her home with dainty hugs and papery soft, not to mention sandpapery dry, kisses on their cheeks. The 3-story Bradley house sprawls more than 7,000 square feet atop the rocky hillside and is filled with room after room of turn-of-the-century antiques. Gwendy has always been terrified of breaking something valuable. She takes her parents' coats and, adding her own, leaves them draped over a Victorian sofa in the library. Then she heads into the bustling, high-ceilinged great room, searching for familiar faces, anxious to make an appearance and get back home again. But, as is often the case in Castle Rock, familiar faces her age prove difficult to find. Most of Gwendy's close friends from high school never returned to the Rock after attending college. Like her, many of them took jobs in nearby Portland or Derry or Bangor. Others moved to distant states, only returning for occasional visits with parents or siblings. Bridget Desjardin is one of only a small handful of exceptions to this rule, and appears to be the only one in attendance here at the Bradleys' annual Christmas party. Gwendy bumps into her by the punch bowl. There are no unfortunate spills this time around, and enjoys a spirited but brief conversation with Bridget and her husband Travis before a PTA friend of Bridget's drunkenly interrupts them. Gwendy smiles and moves on. Of course, there are plenty of others waiting to speak with Gwendy. While familiar faces are scarce, friendly and merely curious faces are not. It seems as if everyone there wants a photo or a quick word or two with the celebrity congresswoman, and the barrage of questions comes fast and furious.
Where's your husband? Where's Ryan?
Overseas, working on assignment.
How's your mom feeling?
Much better, thank you. She's here somewhere. I'm actually trying to find her.
What's President Hamlin really like?
He's a handful.
How's it going down there in D.C.?
Oh, it's going okay. Trying to fight the good fight every day.
Why aren't you drinking? Hold on, let me grab you something.
No, thanks, really. I'm kind of tired and not much of a drinker.
What about those missing girls?
It's terrible and it's frightening, and I know the sheriff and his people are doing everything humanly possible to find them.
I saw you running the other night. Don't you ever get tired of all that running?
Actually, no. I find it relaxing. That's why I do it.
How worried should I be about what's going on with North Korea? Do you think we're going to war?
Don't lose any sleep over it. A lot of awfully bad things would have to happen for the United States to go to war, and I don't believe it's going to happen.
Gwendy's not so sure about this last one, but she figures it's part of her job to keep her constituents calm. By the time she locates her parents sitting in a corner on the opposite side of the room, talking to a co-worker from Dad's office, the man also requests a real quick photo, which Gwendy dutifully smiles for. She feels like she's just finished an all-day publicity whirlwind for one of her book releases. She also has a splitting headache. Once they're alone, she tells her parents she's exhausted and asks if they'll be okay at the party without her. Her mom fusses that Gwendy needs to stop working so hard and orders her right home to bed. Her father gives her a sarcastic look and says, "I think we can survive without your guiding light for one night, kiddo. Go home and get some rest." Gwendy swats him on the arm, kisses them both goodnight, and starts across the room toward the library to get her coat. That's when it happens. A muscular hand reaches out from the sea of people and grabs Gwendy by the shoulder, spinning her around.
"Well, well, well, look who it is."
Caroline Hoffman suddenly looms in front of her, bloodshot eyes narrowed into slits. The hand gripping Gwendy's shoulder begins to squeeze. Her free hand balls into a meaty fist. Gwendy glances around the room looking for help, but Mr. Hoffman is nowhere in sight, and none of the other partygoers seem to have noticed what's happening.
"Mrs. Hoffman, I don't know what..."
"You make me sick, you know that?"
"Well, I'm sorry you feel that way, but I don't know..." The hand squeezes harder.
"Let go of me," Gwendy says, shrugging the woman's hand off of her. She can smell Mrs. Hoffman's breath, and not beer, the hard stuff. The last thing she wants to do is antagonize her.
"Listen, I appreciate the fact that you're upset and you don't like me very much, but this isn't the time or the place."
"I think it's the perfect time and place," Mrs. Hoffman says, an ugly sneer spreading across her face.
"For what?" Gwendy asks heavily.
"For me to kick your stuck-up little ass."
Gwendy takes a step back, raising her hands in front of her, in shock that this is actually happening. "Is everything okay?" a tall man Gwendy has never seen before asks.
"No," she says, voice trembling.
"No, it's not. This woman has had too much to drink and needs a ride home. Can you help her find someone, or perhaps you can call her husband?"
"I'd be happy to."
The man turns to Mrs. Hoffman and tries to take her arm. She shoves him away. He slams into a couple behind him, knocking the other man's wine glass out of his hand. It tumbles to the floor and shatters, and now everyone in the room is staring at the tall stranger, Mrs. Hoffman.
"What are y'all gawking at?"
she slurs, the color rising in her chubby cheeks.
"Bunch of blue ballers."
"Oh my," someone behind Gwendy says. Gwendy takes advantage of the distraction and quickly slips away into the library, where she digs out her coat from the now massive pile on the sofa. She puts it on, rubbing away furious tears, and starts pacing in front of the sofa. How dare she put her hands on me? How dare she say those things? Pacing faster now, she can feel the heat intensifying throughout her body. All I was trying to do was help her rude ass, and she acts like... A loud crash comes from the next room, and then cries of alarm. Gwendy hurries back into the great room, afraid of what she might find. Caroline Hoffman is lying unconscious on the hardwood floor, her arms splayed above her head. A nasty gash on her forehead is bleeding heavily. A crowd has gathered around her.
"What happened?" Gwendy asks no one in particular.
"She fell," an old man standing in front of her says. "She calmed down some and was walking out on her own. She just spun around and fell and hit her head on the table. Darndest thing I ever seen."
It was almost like somebody pushed her, another woman says. But there wasn't anybody there.
Remembering the flush of anger she'd just experienced, and a long-forgotten dream about Frankie Stone, Gwendy stumbles out of the house in a daze and doesn't look back. Head spinning, it takes her several minutes to remember where she parked her car. When she finally locates it near the bottom of the Bradley's long driveway, she gets in and drives home in silence. 45. When Gwendy gets home 15 minutes later, she changes into a nightgown, washes her face and brushes her teeth, and goes directly to bed. She doesn't turn on the television, she doesn't put her cell phone on charge, and for the first time since its return, she leaves the button box locked inside the safe overnight. 46. Gwendy doesn't check on the button box the next morning either. Another first for her. Christmas dawns dark and gloomy, with a suffocating layer of thick clouds hanging over Castle Rock. The weather forecast calls for snow by nightfall, and the town DPW trucks are already busy dropping salt as Gwendy makes her way down Route 117 to her parents' house. Almost all of the homes she passes still have their Christmas lights glowing at 10:30 in the morning. For some reason, instead of looking cheerful and festive, the dim lights and murky sky provide a depressing backdrop to her drive. Gwendy expects to pass the day in the same blue mood she went to bed with, but is determined to hide it from her parents. They have enough on their plate without her ruining their Christmas celebration. But by the time the brunch table is cleared and presents are exchanged in the living room, Gwendy finds herself in a surprisingly cheery mood. Something about spending Christmas morning in the house she grew up in makes the world feel safe and small again, if only for a short time. As they do every year, Mr. and Mrs. Peterson fret about Gwendy going overboard and spoiling them with gifts. "We asked you not to do that this year, honey. We didn't have much time to get out and shop." But she can tell they're surprised and pleased with her choices. Dad, still dressed in a robe and pajamas, sits in his recliner with his legs up, reading the instructions for his brand new DVD player. Mom is busy modeling her L.L. Bean jacket and boots in the full-length hallway mirror. A stack of jigsaw puzzles, assorted shirts and sweaters, a TiVo so Mom can digitally record her shows, a men's L.L. Bean winter jacket, and subscription gift cards to National Geographic and People magazine sit under the tree, next to Ryan's unopened presents. Gwendy is equally pleased with her own gifts, particularly a gorgeous leather-bound journal her mother found in a small shop in Bangor. She's sitting on the living room sofa, relishing the texture of the thick paper against her fingertips, when her father reaches out with a large red envelope in his hand.
"One more little present, Gwenny."
"What's this?" she asks, taking the envelope.
"A surprise," Mrs. Peterson says, coming over and sitting on the arm of her husband's recliner. Gwendy opens the envelope and slides out a card. A glittery Christmas tree decorates the front of it. A little girl with pigtails stands at the foot of the tree, looking up with wonder in her eyes. Gwendy opens the card, and a small white feather spills out and flutters to the carpet at her feet. "Is that?" she starts to ask, eyes wide, and then she reads what her father has written inside the card. "You have always believed in magic, dear Gwendy, and magic has always believed in you." And she can no longer find the words to finish. She looks up at her parents. They're both sitting there with goofy grins on their faces. Happy tears are forming in her mother's eyes. Gwendy bends down and picks up the feather, stares at it with disbelief.
"I just can't..."
She turns the feather over in her hand.
"How did you... where did you find it?"
"I found it in the garage," her father says proudly. "I was looking for a 3/8-inch screw in one of those cabinets you liked to play with so much when you were little. The ones with all the little drawers."
Gwendy mutely nods her head.
"Slid out the last drawer in the last row, and there it was. I couldn't believe it myself."
"You must have hidden it there," her mother says. "What, almost 30 years ago?"
"I don't remember," Gwendy says. She looks up at her parents, and this time she's the one wearing the big, goofy grin.
"I can't believe you found my magic feather."
47.
When Gwendy is 10 years old, her family spends a week in upstate New York visiting with one of Mr. Peterson's first cousins. It's July, and the cousin, Gwendy can no longer remember his name, nor the names of his wife or three children. As best she can recall, they never saw them again except at the occasional wedding or funeral, has a summer home on a lake, so there's plenty to do. Canoeing, swimming, fishing, jumping off tire swings, even water skiing. There's also a small town nearby with a mini golf course and water slide for the tourists. Gwendy looks forward to the trip all summer long. She starts saving her money as soon as the school year ends, stashing away the quarters she makes from helping her father clean the garage and dusting the house from top to bottom for her mother. By the time she packs her own suitcase and climbs into the back seat for the 7-hour drive, she's managed to save almost $15 in loose change. Her plan is to hold on to most of the money until the final 2 days of the trip, and then splurge on herself. Candy, comics, ice cream, maybe even a pocket transistor radio with an earphone if she has enough left over. But it doesn't work out that way. Within minutes of their arrival, Mr. and Mrs. Peterson disappear into the cabin for a grand tour, and Gwendy finds herself standing by the car, surrounded by a group of local kids, including the cousin's three children, who are all spending the summer at the lake. The boys are shirtless and tan and look wild with their messy hair and sugar-spiked eyes. The girls are long-legged and aloof and mostly older. Nervous and not knowing what else to say, Gwendy eventually unzips her suitcase and shows the kids her plastic marble bag filled with quarters. Most of them are indifferent, and a few even laugh at her. But one of the older boys doesn't laugh. He seems interested and maybe even impressed. He waits until the other kids all run off, whooping and hollering into the backyard, and then he approaches Gwendy. "Hey, kid," he says, looking around. "I got something you might be interested in." "What?" Gwendy asks, even more nervous now that she's alone with a boy, a cute older boy. He reaches into the back pocket of his cut-off jean shorts, and when his hand swims back into view, it's holding something small and fluffy and white. "A feather?" Gwendy asks, confused. A look of disgust comes onto the older boy's face. "Not just any old feather. It's a magic feather." Gwendy feels her heart flutter. "Magic? That's right. It once belonged to an Indian chief who used to live around here. He was also a medicine man, a very powerful one." Gwendy swallows. "What does it do?" "It does magic stuff," he says. "You know, like bringing you good luck and making you smarter, stuff like that." "Can I hold it?" Gwendy asks almost breathlessly. "Sure, but I'm getting kind of tired taking care of it. I've had it for a few years now. You interested in taking it off my hands? You want to give it to me?" "Not give," he says. "Sell." Gwendy doesn't miss a beat. "How much?" The boy lifts a dirty finger to his lips, thinking. "I guess $10 is a fair enough price." Gwendy's shoulders sag a little. "I don't know. That's a lot of money." "Not for a magic feather, it ain't." He starts to put the feather back in his pocket. "No biggie. I'll just sell it to someone else." "Wait," Gwendy blurts. "I didn't say no." He looks down his nose at her. "You didn't say yes, either." Gwendy glances at the plastic bag filled with quarters and then looks at the feather again. "Tell you what," the boy says. "You're new around here, so I'll cut you a deal. How's $9 sound?" Gwendy feels as if she's just won the grand prize at the spinning wheel booth at the Castle Rock 4th of July Carnival. "Deal," she says at once, and starts counting out $9 in quarters.